Well, thank you for having me here on this beautiful fall morning, and I'm delighted to spend a few minutes sharing with you some of the work that we've been doing that now goes back almost 30 years. So this reflects a lot of what I've been spending my time on for quite a long period of time. So let me give you a quick overview of what I want to talk about. I'm going to talk about caregiving in generally and focus to some extent specifically in Alzheimer's disease caregiving. Look at what happens to caregivers as they go through this process, and then share with you some of the research that we've done that addresses some of the problems and challenges that caregivers face and gets them to a better place in terms of being able to deal with these issues, and then talk about what's going to happen in the future. Sort of project forward 10, 20, 30 years in terms of the kinds of challenges we're going to face with respect to caring for the older adults in the U.S. So just some general comments about caregiving in general. You know, there are lots of different kinds of caregiving. Mothers take care of children. Anytime there's a hospital discharge, somebody typically gets involved in taking care of that individual post-hospital discharge, and there are many of those every year. But what I'm going to focus on is caring for older adults with chronic disability, and those could be cognitively based and or involve limitations in one's ability to engage in daily activities. And it's estimated, and this is a conservative estimate, there are about 17 million Americans in any given year that are involved in providing chronic care to older adults. And to put that in perspective in terms of what it does for the nation as a whole in terms of the healthcare system, if you had to purchase these services, if you had to pay for that care that family members are providing, you'd be spending close to $400 billion a year, which is more than we currently spend on long-term care-related services in the U.S. So if you look specifically at Alzheimer's disease, we have about 5.4 million. It's estimated that there are 15 million family members involved in their care, and that care alone is valued at about $200 billion annually. And, of course, there are high levels of distress associated with being an Alzheimer's disease caregiver. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot to report with respect to progress in treating the disease. The number of individuals is still rising. It's our most expensive medical condition right now, and it's estimated to cost us about $214 billion a year. We're much better at diagnosing the condition now than we used to be. It's unlikely we're going to find a cure by 2025, but current estimates suggest. We've tried a lot of strategies for clearing these amyloid, these proteins that accumulate in people's brains, but everything we've done to date really has not had a major impact on the disease. And it may be that if we're talking about people over the age of 80 and 90, really looking at conditions that involve lots of factors related to aging. So the picture overall isn't real optimistic at this point, but there's a lot of work going on right now, and that will continue certainly for the next decade or so. So what happens to caregivers as they move through this caregiving experience? And the way I like to break it down is in terms of this process where you begin with providing some sporadic care, there's some problems you have to deal with. You notice the individual you're caring for is not able to do the things they used to be able to do. This typically evolves into what we call IADL-type caregiving, assisting them with daily activities. And this expands ultimately to ADL-type care, where they're having difficulty eating or dressing, and finally one of two things happens. You either get into, the person may be placed under some circumstances, or they may die at the home. Both of those occur fairly frequently. And at each stage in this process, there are a lot of things that caregivers are asked to do. When you start out, you're doing light errands, you're communicating with the person's health care provider, you're taking them to appointments, and this then grows. You begin to get involved in monitoring symptoms, you have to manage finances, sometimes hire care providers, and it grows further as you move down the chain with respect to the kinds of challenges that caregivers have to face. And you can ask some interesting questions along the way here. What are the health effects of moving through this trajectory, and what can you do about it? And that's really where we've been focusing much of our research for the last 30 years. You know, what can you really show with respect to how it impacts the caregiver, and what can you do about it once you have a better understanding of that? And here are some things that happen, you observe normally. If you look at caregivers before and after taking on the role, what you typically see, is illustrated here, where before the caregiving role, levels of depressive symptoms are relatively low, and then they become quite elevated. You can see it also in terms of self-care. People are doing a poor job of caring for themselves after they take on the caregiving role. You can also monitor chronic disease in the caregiver. And here's a heavy-duty caregiver, and over time they get worse much faster than someone who's not engaged in a caregiving role. So there, it begins to show you that there are some real costs associated with taking on this role, including the possibility that being a caregiver increases your risk of mortality by about 63%, controlling for other things. So if you summarize all of this, in the early stages, there's some anxiety and burden. This, in some cases, evolves into psychiatric and physical morbidity. So real disease that begins to occur in the caregiver as a result of the challenges they're facing in caring for a relative. And you can summarize all of this. I won't go through this in any detail, but you do get increased depression, poor health, poor self-care, losing weight, and so on. So what happens when the care recipient dies? It's another stage in the process that we've examined, looking at the caregiving experience all the way through the death of the care recipient. And when you look at that, you see these are some exemplary data where the top line represents depressive symptoms in a caregiver before and after death, and you see it's high before, as you'd expect, because they're in that caregiving role, and it stays high after the death. Interestingly, it doesn't get worse. It stays at relatively the same level, whereas people who don't, who aren't involved in the caregiving experience, these individuals here actually do get worse as a result of death. So it's that typical, death as stressor phenomenon for these individuals, but relatively little additional negative impact if you're coming out of a caregiving role experience. And you see this in other data as well, taking antidepressant medications before and after death. It's only the non-caregivers that have this problem. It's not the caregiver. So you're beginning to see that in some ways, and maybe in a sadistic kind of way, caregiving is protective when it comes to the death of the care recipient, at least for some individuals. And here's some data we published a few years ago looking at depressive symptoms over time, and this is weeks after the death of the person you've been caring for. In this case, it's an Alzheimer's disease patient. And what's interesting is you see this peak in depressive symptomatology right after death, as you might expect, but very rapid recovery if you follow those individuals for 10 or 20 weeks. They're right back to normative levels of functioning with respect to depressive symptoms. And one of the reasons we believe that happens is that in the context of this kind of caregiving, death really becomes a relief. It's, from the caregiver's point of view, it's a relief for the patient to have died, and it's a relief to them that this experience is now over. And unfortunately, if you ask the same kinds of questions about the placement experience, or what happens when people place their relative into a long-term care facility, there the picture is not as encouraging in terms of what happens to the caregiver. They continue to be anxious and depressed. And you see this in a couple of studies we've illustrated here. They really don't show the kind of recovery that's associated with the death of the care recipient here. And the reason for that, you can imagine there are probably several. One might be guilt at having to place a relative in a long-term care facility. Another might be that they continue to be involved with the patient. They visit, many people visit on a daily basis. They continue to provide help to the individual and may help them eat or dress or take care of other daily activities. So all of these things contribute to an experience that's really a continuation of caregiving rather than an end, as some people might expect. So if you look at the whole trajectory, this is the picture that emerges. And this has been an important picture to paint because it's helped elevate caregiving nationally and identify it as an important public health issue. This is something we need to pay attention to and do something about. And these kinds of data have been important in helping us make that point. So that's some of the negative news. Now let me shift to something a little more positive, which is strategies for helping the caregiver deal with these challenges. Given that there are these negative health effects, both psychologically and physically, what can you do to help the caregiver to ease the burden of providing that kind of care? And I'll talk briefly about it. This is a very large study we did in the early 2000s up to about 2006, 2007, paid for by the federal government. It was designed to develop intervention strategies for caregivers of persons with Alzheimer's disease. And it involved multiple cities around the country. So the first thing you want to do is, and I want to make sure this point is clear, not all caregivers suffer in the way that I've described in the earlier slides. Some do just fine throughout the whole experience. So if you're going to help someone, you need to have some strategy for identifying who needs help. And these are the kinds of factors that you look for. These are risk factors for negative outcomes. You're having to provide high levels of care, low income, living with the care recipient, being older, having less education, being female, having no choice, being depressed, and so on and so forth. So these are the factors we look for to identify people who might benefit from a caregiver intervention. And so what we do is we administer this risk appraisal to find out who is at risk for a negative outcome and what their specific problems might be. We develop an intervention based on that risk profile, and then we do the outcomes assessment. And the intervention strategies that we use in these studies were designed to address the problems you see listed here, things like burden, problem behaviors, often identified by caregivers as being a major source of distress. Social support and integration. Are they getting help and support from others in their environment? Are they taking care of themselves? How are they doing emotionally? And their strategies for addressing depressive symptoms? And finally, in all aspects of the study, we addressed issues of safety. And you'd be amazed at how many care recipients with fairly advanced dementia are still driving, have access to weapons or medications. And so those are the things we look for first, and we address those immediately. Well, so here are some of the strategies. So if the issue is a safety issues like driving, having access to weapons, you do a home assessment, make appropriate alterations, and you eliminate these target risk behaviors. If the issue is self-care and preventive health behaviors, we develop this health passport intervention where people monitor their own activities with respect to self-care, and this resulted in them taking better care of themselves. If you're looking at issues of support, we provide information and referral sources. We also established a support group that was organized via telephone, and that seemed to be very effective in making caregivers feel that there are others in this with them. And for things like depression and distress, we have strategies for relaxation and pleasant events training, and these, again, were also very successful in helping the caregiver deal with this particular aspect of the caregiving experience. And in this particular study, we had Hispanics, whites, and African Americans, and we had, for each of them, we had two groups. We had a treatment group who got all these interventions, and we had a control group that did not receive these interventions. They just received supportive telephone calls. That's the only intervention they received. And you see here the difference between intervention and control for each of the different ethnic racial groups, and they were quite large. And you see that this was especially true for Hispanics, and the intervention was delivered in Spanish for that group. Also for whites, a little less so for blacks, but across the board, people who participated in the intervention did much better than individuals who were not part of this. So when we published this work back in 2006 in a medical journal, we were very pleased to see an editorial published along with it that said if these interventions were drugs, it's hard to believe they wouldn't be on the fast track for approval. And in fact, this intervention has been expanded and applied in lots of different contexts. It's now used as part of the VA treatment program. It's been adopted by numerous state agencies. It's been replicated in Hong Kong and Germany, and is also being used in mainland China. And most recently, it's been adopted by the Indian Health Service. So it's really had a large impact in terms of being disseminated very broadly, and we think has had a big impact with respect to alleviating the distress and burden of caregiving. We've also moved to using technology to deliver the intervention instead of humans. So we can now deliver the intervention via these interactive video telephones. There's a study in Miami looking at that right now. And it's essentially doing the same thing, but at a distance without as much resources needed in order to deliver it. So on the whole, we've shown that these interventions are, in some cases, very, but often moderately successful. They have to be multi-component. There's no silver bullet to a caregiver intervention that does the job completely. You have to attack multiple problems simultaneously. There are a lot of ways you can deliver these interventions, and technology in particular is proving to be a very effective way to do this. So let's talk about the future now. Let's look ahead 10 to 20 years. We all know about the aging of the baby boomer generation, and there we have an interesting problem in that individuals who are currently older adults in the U.S. have the benefit of having had relatively large numbers of children who are available to provide care to them. Well, that's going to shift. As the baby boomers age, they had fewer children, so you're going to have this mismatch between the number of individuals needing care, getting older and becoming disabled and needing support and care, and the number of individuals available behind them who can provide that care. You also have increased longevity, and in many cases it also involves extended periods of disability. You have this fear that we currently faced with respect to the impact of the obesity epidemic. And one thought is that this will increase disability rates in the future, so that the next generation of older persons will have more disability because of this than the current generation. As I mentioned, there are fewer children available to provide care. More women are in the workforce. That makes them less available. You have geographic disbursement. We also have a healthcare workforce that doesn't have adequate geriatric training. We know that our healthcare systems are already highly constrained, and they're likely to become more constrained because the costs are running out of control. So who's going to fill this gap? What's likely to happen? Well, in lots of European countries, the individuals who fill the gap are foreigners, foreign workers who, in some cases, will work in long-term care facilities, as they do to some extent here in the U.S., but also in the home. It's not uncommon in a European household to have somebody who's from Eastern Europe who's providing the care and living with you. This may have an impact in our own country. We're seeing some of that. If you go to a lot of long-term care facilities, particularly in the East, you will see lots of immigrants working in those positions. And this may ultimately have some impact on the immigration debate in the U.S. So what might happen? Well, those baby boomers are going to have a political clout. If they are able to act as a unit, it's conceivable that they're going to vote lots of nice services for themselves that will address some of these problems. And this could, of course, create some intergenerational conflict. Younger individuals might not be so favorably disposed toward that. And some of you may remember when we were building the stadiums here in the city, there was sort of a young-old conflict arising locally in that older individuals were less enthusiastic about building new stadiums than younger individuals, and this created some interesting discussions on the radio call-in shows. We're likely to have increased controls on chronic care costs. We continue to see that. The U.S. is continuing to explore ways in which to improve both the quality and reduce the cost, and that's a tough thing to achieve. And this is a very positive note. Much more so than ever before, we see this emphasis on healthy aging and the adoption of healthy aging strategies with respect to diet and exercise, and it's conceivable that this will have significant impact on disability rates. So if we can get lots of people engaged in taking better care of themselves, it's conceivable that that disability will be delayed until very, very late in life and therefore require a lot less intervention and support. The other thing that's happening, and I think will continue to increase, that's this greater acceptance of death and end-of-life care planning. You see that in with respect to palliative care strategies that are being much more broadly implemented than they were before. And I think we will see this greater acceptance in the long term of what we might call aid in dying. There are other phrases that have been used that are less popular, but I think the whole notion of giving individuals a dignified death with not lots of interventions that drag things out unneedfully is something we're likely to see in the future. The other big trend that I think will happen relatively soon is a much better integration of the caregiver into the health care of the older individuals. Right now, within most health care systems, caregivers are marginalized. They're there and helping out, and they're assumed to be available to provide care. But you know, when was the last time a physician asked the caregiver, "Are you able to do the things we're assuming you're going to do? Are you going to be able to provide the wound care that this person needs in order to for them to recover appropriately?" So right now, there is no deliberate or conscious attempt on the part of the healthcare system to assess what the capacity of the caregiver is, to figure out where they're at in terms of their abilities and their emotional well-being. And I think that's going to change. I think we'll move toward this system where it will be the emphasis will be on family-centered as opposed to person-centered care. You know, right now, the catchphrase is person-centered care, where care is specifically tailored to the individual. Well, I think in the future we're going to need care that is tailored to the family as a unit as opposed to the person who is sick. We will see increased support services to enable individuals to continue to live at home. And going along with all of these strategies will be larger cost-benefit studies to see where and how these strategies are saving money. We're also going to see more technology, and we've been involved with colleagues at Carnegie Mellon in developing a whole variety of technologies to support individuals with disability, and I think that will increase. There's a lot of monitoring technology. There's a lot of coaching technology that's now being used for persons with cognitive problems, and a lot of the interventions that used to be delivered in person, one-on-one, will be delivered via technology platforms. And finally, we'll see workplace supports for caregiving will evolve and increase as well. We don't have in this country, as they do in Europe, formal policies with respect to giving people time off to take care of a relative under extreme circumstances. You can do that to some extent in some states under the Family Leave Act, but it's rarely used in that way, and I think we'll see more of that and explicit identification as caregiving being an appropriate way to use those kinds of resources. And that's where I'm going to end and be happy to answer any questions you might have. Yes, sir. Okay. For about the past 10 years, Pitt and Carnegie Mellon have had this center called the Quality of Life Technology Engineering Research Center, whose mission was, and still is, to design technologies for individuals with disability and older individuals. And it was exactly the mission that you just described. And that particular system or organization has been very heavily engaged in pursuing all kinds of leads in terms of technology development. I'll give you some examples. There's a coaching game-based rehab system that has been developed. When people have strokes, for example, in some cases, they're supposed to do exercises that cause them to move their arms in particular ways. And people at CMU have been able to build that into a game so that essentially the game causes you to move your arm in the way that you're supposed to be doing your rehab. So there are those kinds of examples. There's all kinds of coaching-based systems for people with cognitive impairment that are built into kitchens so that it can be as explicit as monitoring you prepare a particular recipe or a particular type of meal, and it knows what the steps are for completing that meal or that recipe, and it can tell you when you're deviating and get you back on track. And this was work we were doing in as part of that quote center. A lot of the automatic car driving technology is really motivated in part for older people. I mean, we did some work with Nissan, and their explicit goal was to extend the driving life of older individuals by 10 years on average. We want everybody to be driving 10 years longer than they currently are. And the way you do that is you automate all these processes. People at CMU developed a self-parking system where you drop a car off, it finds its own parking space and parks itself. Well, it's all controlled off your cell phone. You just press a button on your cell phone and it goes and comes when you call it. So those are some of the things I'm trying to remember. There are a lot of strategies. The ones that are easy, the lowest hanging fruit, are technologies that are linked to very specific disease or disability states, like the stroke example I gave you, where you have to do a specific thing, or you have to do a series of special rehab exercises. Those can be computerized. You can have monitoring systems to see how you're doing, and they can give you online feedback to correct you, to get you to do it right. One of the big challenges in a lot of these systems is the motivational component. You know, you can design good technology, but you also have to get people to use them, and I think that's sort of a problem that exists across the board with all technologies, that becomes particularly challenging when you're looking at rehab kinds of interventions that are supposed to help people. I'm trying to think if there's any other... Oh, yeah, that's already here. I mean, the VA has remote monitoring of vital signs, basically. In-home monitoring that's connected to a system and is monitored. You know, someone at the hospital or at the clinic is monitoring how you're doing. So those things are already in place. The thing that hasn't happened yet, there have been some big trials to try to see if that's better and cheaper than having human beings do that, having a nurse go out, for example, to monitor your blood pressure or check your weight if you have congestive heart failure or something like that. And they've shown that it's just as good as, but they haven't been able to show that it's cheaper than. So that's part of the challenge still. You know, how do you scale these things up to a level where it really does begin to save money? But you know, I definitely think that this is a big deal, and there are lots of opportunities, and we're likely to see lots of changes in a relatively short period of time in terms of the application of technologies. And I think Pittsburgh is going to be the center of is one of the national centers where this is going to happen. I'm very optimistic about what we might achieve with those kinds of strategies. Yes. Sure.
But with the work that I do, I'm starting to run into people that are okay, 95 and up.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they come and ask, I have to talk to them, and usually I have to place them in a nursing home lately. But they don't want to live with their children.
Mm. Problems, yeah.
And I'm probably their great granddaughter, and I try not to laugh, or it's like a tornado really profound.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my clientele are 95 and up, and they were just told that they cannot drive anymore because of their vision.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty much well educated. But is there a new study, or I think it's going to be an epidemic.
Well, what part? You mean lots of people moving into their 90s? And Yeah.
My oldest is 97.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 102.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine a future where you have three generations all living, and the youngest generation is 60 years old. That it does raise questions about, you know, who's going to care for whom when you have a 90 year and a 70-year-old son or daughter and a 50-year-old granddaughter and so on. So, but we will see. We will continue to see increases in longevity. They won't be as dramatic as they have been over the last 30, 40 years. But people will more frequently live into their late 80s and 90s and even the hundreds. And it'll be interesting to see at what level of functioning remains for large segments of the population who make it there. And, you know, anecdotally, I see it all the time. There are lots of very high-functioning 90-year-olds out there, and I think we'll see more of that in the future.
As the generations shrink, that is, fewer children being born,
mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the fears that we have with the baby boomers, that there's lots of baby boomers. We're going to see this large surge in the increase of older individuals, and they haven't had a whole lot of children to care for them. And the question is, who's going to fill in? Who's going to be the person or the organization that provides the care that they need? Now, you could argue that as long as you had one child, you're okay. Maybe in most cases, you know, there is a primary caregiver. There's one person, even if there are multiple children, there's one person who sort of takes on the load. It's usually a daughter. So you may be okay with just having had one child, but if you've had no child, and then you obviously have, that poses serious problems, and people need to think about that. I'm in that position myself, and you do think about, well, who will I rely on? And you start thinking about making nice to your nieces and nephews so that they might help out. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Pretty impressive stuff, and I'd like to understand a little bit more about what these interventions are like
mm-hmm.
to alter the burden.
Okay, I'll give you a sense of pragmatically what's involved. They typically involve about 12 one-hour sessions with the caregiver. And in the initial study, it was done in the caregiver's home, so you actually go into their home. The front end has a lot to do with assessing where they're at. I mean, people say that if you've met one caregiver, you've met one caregiver, that it's always different, the experience is always different. That assessment is used to really shape an intervention that's tailored very much to what that person needs. And in some cases, all you need to do is ask them, what are the biggest problems you face? And you work on those problems. And a lot of times, some of the key elements that keep coming up is the complexity of care coordination. The systems we have here and the silos with respect to services for older individuals are such that you have to be a computer to understand the complexity and access the systems that currently might be relevant to taking care of an older individual. So a lot of work goes into teaching people, helping them figure out where they can get what to support the care of a given individual. Another key element that's almost always in play is some form of emotion regulation, teaching them how to deal with the fact that they do feel depressed. And in some cases, it's helping them understand that they don't need to feel guilty about the fact that they can't do much about the disability their relative has experienced. So getting them to a place where they accept their own limitations with respect to what they can do under the circumstances. With dementia caregiving, we also typically spend some time in helping them understand and to some extent regulate what we call problem behaviors in the care recipient. You know, they may be acting out. They may be highly disruptive. And often caregivers will take that personally. They feel it's directed at them, and it makes them feel badly. So helping them understand where that's coming from is important. And then also helping them, showing them how some of these behaviors are contingent on what they're doing, that they can actually change their behaviors to down-regulate these disruptive behaviors that the care recipient is emitting. And we recently did a study, for example, where we had the caregiver wear a camera so that we're capturing the interaction between them and the person with dementia. And so we can do a very fine-grained analysis of what it, on the circumstances under which the care recipient becomes disruptive. And I mean, it's pretty eye-opening to see how the caregiver is actually facilitating and causing these things. And it's relatively easy to teach them how to limit a few behaviors and things settle down after that. So those are the kinds of strategies we use in these interventions. They're all highly manualized and they're publicly available. And you know, anybody can try and implement them who might be interested. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, some people, and you know, they're a significant proportion of the population. I'd say at least 30-40% does just fine. They don't. If they're not doing fine and they're not interested in what you have to offer, there's not much you can do. Yeah. Yeah.
It increased, but it just continued, and that can continue for years.
Well, no, it doesn't. That I showed you a couple of data points. One is just immediately before and after, and there you didn't see any change. But if you follow people after long enough, you see that they recover pretty well, so that they actually do show a lot of improvement in terms of depressive symptoms. Especially if the caregiving experience has been extremely burdensome and difficult for them. So you can understand why that might be happening.
And
so,
some people may be resistant to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir?
Does the Affordable Care Act address any of these issues?
The Affordable Care Act does include some language about being sensitive to the role of caregivers and recognizes the importance of caregiving as part of the healthcare system, but it doesn't have any teeth in it with respect to requiring, say, formal assessment of the caregiver to see what capacity they have to do the things that they're being asked to do. So. And I think that's going to be the next generation of legislation. It's going to identify caregivers as legitimate entities and that need to be included in the...
Do you think it's a significant enough problem to require more legislation?
Or? Yeah, I think so. And it'll require some money, too, because you'll need to, you know, once you... ask physicians to assess the caregiver's status, you'll need to pay for it, too. It takes time and effort, and so there'll need to be provisions of how you're going to pay for that. So those are some of the things that are coming down the line. And I'll tell you that the I currently chair a committee at the National Institute of Medicine that is in the process of writing caregiver policy. And that's going to come out next April, May. So we'll see some formal articulation. Well, we'll see both a review of the scientific literature and growing out of that an articulation of policy recommendations. And usually when the IOM issues policy recommendations, they're at least looked at very closely. So we may see some enactment after that. Yeah, well, this is a problem for them, and there's an additional dimension to it in that the young people have been leaving rural areas and moving to the cities, leaving the older generation behind, and this is a big problem in China right now. And
in addition to the fact that
if
they have only one child,
yes,
spoil this child.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's not a good formula. and doesn't portend well for the future of the older generations in China. Japan has a similar situation, although they have they instituted about 10 years ago mandatory long-term care insurance was a strategy that they adopted, and they kind of snuck it in without people really realizing it was happening. It became part of employer insurance, and the system was set up. So starting at the age 40, you had to start paying into this fund, anticipating that the younger generation wasn't going to be available to provide care for older persons in Japan. And we tend to think of these societies as being, you know, highly family-oriented and supportive, but a lot of that is exaggerated in Chinese and Japanese culture. It's not as rosy as we've been led to believe with respect to, you know, the younger generation being an incredible source of support for the older generation. I think it's probably more so truer here than it is over there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because maybe you're part of the issue in creating behaviors in your Alzheimer's folks when they're not sort of resistant but unable to accept the data because their own burden prevents them from seeing the implications of it. Mm-hmm. Any data on how effective it is to intervene by referring them to stress management or providing tools to deal with that? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a lot of what we do with the interventions that we've tried is exactly that. You know, we give them sort of a third-party perspective on what's really going on, and by doing that, helping them understand their role in this whole configuration. And I think that's partly why these interventions are effective. That and getting them to understand the disease processes that the person may be subject to, that you know, and that these behaviors are not personally motivated and they're uncontrollable from the recipient's point of view and so forth. So I think what you've described, the sort of whole stress management strategy, is what these interventions are really all about. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Based on some of your earlier material that you presented, mm-hmm. if a parent or if a care receiver
Well, it's a tough comparison to make because the functional status of the person in a long-term care facility is usually so much worse than it is in the home. Placing someone in a long-term care facility is really an act of last resort. It really doesn't happen until the person is very disabled, cognitively and or physically. And, you know, you see some of that in the home. And certainly from the perspective of the recipient, I think you would always find that they'd rather be at home than be in a strange long-term care facility. That's always their preference. In terms of how it affects the caregiver, I mean, if you have resources available to help care for that individual, it makes a big difference. I mean, having respite opportunities, having professional care is a very important part of the picture. And I think that's one of the things we'll see more of in the future is figuring out ways in which you can have the person stay at home and get the professional care that would allow even a very disabled, cognitively impaired person to remain in the home.
Just based on your knowledge, what if a person decides to go into a retirement situation that has the continuum of care? It seems to me that number one, the person chooses, the care receiver chooses to do that, which might make it easier for the caregiver, and then there is that progression.
I would agree that would be, and that is, for those who can afford it, that is a progression that people often go through, that they'll start with assisted living and adapt to a setting in that context. And the caregiver may remain involved, moderately involved in providing support and care in that setting, and as things get worse, but it does allow for sort of transitioning in place, and that's better for the care recipient than an abrupt shift from home to a long-term care facility. And it's probably better for the caregiver as well in terms of the burden on them. Yeah. Sure.
Are there types of services that are greater stress relievers for the caregiver than others?
Yeah. In general, respite care is always a biggie. Having the opportunity to leave the scene to do something else for a day or 2 days or maybe even a week. And if you can do that by engaging other family members, that's the best kind of solution. But in some cases, it can also be done by bringing in professionals to provide care while you're away for a while. So respite is a biggie. Another thing that's increasingly happening is that caregivers are being asked to give ever more complex care in the home without any formal training. And this is another thing we're going to see is if you ask a caregiver to give injections on a daily basis or get involved in wound healing or any one of a number of complex medical interventions, you got to make sure they're able to do this. And we don't do that currently. We sort of give them a sheet and say, okay, this is a list of things you need to do in order for this patient to recover or do well, and we leave it at that. So that's something that will likely change in the future. But having professionals take over some of these complex medical tasks that some caregivers are very nervous about doing is another big help for the caregiver. So those are sort of two kinds of activities or supports that seem to be very important.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. I'll, thank you.